Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, best-selling author of the book, The Fitness Mindset and Rewire Your Mindset, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest is the perfect guest in the lead-up to the new year. Again, you might be listening to this outside of the new year, but a very applicable one for right now. Today's guest is Dr. Judd on unwinding anxiety, using curiosity to manage cravings, and finally breaking your bad habits. If I could handpick a guest who specialized in topics that really connect with this particular podcast, it's Dr. Judd. His areas of expertise are habit formation and habit change, emotional eating. He's developed the Eat Right Now app, which helps people with emotional eating and anxiety, and that connection between anxiety, food, overeating, cravings, and designing strategies that help you break yourself out of those anxiety habit loops or craving habit loops. So today's podcast, we jump into a lot of different topics around anxiety, around cravings, and finally breaking any of your bad habits. So I loved this podcast. I've been following Dr. Judd's stuff for a long time now, and I've been looking forward to this podcast for quite a while. So without further ado, here is the last episode of 2021, rounding off the year in style. Dr. Judd on unwinding anxiety, using curiosity to manage cravings, and finally breaking your bad habits. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guest, Dr. Judd Brewer. Dr. Judd is a New York Times bestselling author, neuroscientist, addiction psychiatrist, and thought leader in the field of habit change. He is the director of research and innovation at Brown University's Mindfulness Center, where he also serves as an associate professor at the School of Public Health and the School of Medicine at Brown University. He is an executive medical director of behavioral health at Share Care Inc. and a research affiliate at MIT. Dr. Judd has developed and tested novel mindfulness programs for habit change, including treatments for smoking, emotional eating, and anxiety. He's the author of The Craving Mind, From Cigarettes to Smartphones to Love, Why We Get Hooked and How We Can Break Bad Habits, and Unwinding Anxiety. New science shows how to break the cycles of worry and fear to heal your mind. I'm looking forward to talking all things mental health, anxiety, cravings, and mindset in general in today's episode. Dr. Judd, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really looking forward to this. As I said to you right before we went on air, I've consumed a lot of your content through Instagram, through the books, through other podcasts that you've been on. So I'm really looking forward to unpacking a lot of different topics today. But just for the listeners who may not have read your books or may not have followed you online, can you give us a little bit of a backstory, Dr. Judd, into kind of what led you on your path now? And then we'll dive into a lot of different directions in today's episode.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'll keep it brief. But basically, you know, I was stressed out before I started medical school, and I started meditating my first day of medical school, and it helped me realize how little I knew about my own mind. And it actually led my own exploration led me to become a psychiatrist. You know, I wasn't planning to do that. And after, you know, about 8 years of practice, after going through my MD PhD program, I decided to shift my entire research career from studying molecular biology to retooling to do brain imaging, clinical studies, neuroscience, and really dive into the study of how to change habits, both break unhelpful habits, but also even foster helpful ones.
I'm going to unpack habits as we go along because it's such a massive part of your research and something that so many people struggle with. But before we do that, I want to dive into the book, the new book in particular, in Unwinding Anxiety, the most recent book, because I think it gives us a nice little segue into habit change when we talk about anxiety as a habit loop, etc. But talk about anxiety and anxiety going viral. It's very early on in the book where you talk about this, and we have areas that we might cover when it comes to social media and anxiety. But talk to us a little bit about anxiety and why the book, Unwinding Anxiety in particular.
Yeah. So this wasn't something I'd learned in medical school. And I was actually struggling myself with helping my patients with anxiety. Typically, you know, I've been taught to prescribe medications. The problem is that medications only help about 1 in 5 people. So that is problematic for the other 4 that aren't helped. And also problematic for me because I can't predict who's going to benefit. And I didn't know what to do with the other folks. So I went back and I was actually studying. We have this app called Eat Right Now that my lab was studying that helps people with stress and emotional eating and overeating. And somebody in that program said to me, hey, you know, it's actually anxiety that's driving my stress eating. Can you create a program for that? And that put a bug in my ear to go back and look at the scientific literature to see what I was missing. And lo and behold, back in the 1980s, you know, long time ago, people were talking about anxiety that could be driven as a habit. And that just blew my mind because, you know, here I am a habit researcher. Here I'm an addiction psychiatrist, and I'd never connected the two. You know, how can anxiety be driven like a habit? So the book actually was born out of me. I wanted to create a program to see if we could actually help people with anxiety. I wanted to study it. Long story short, we created this Unwinding Anxiety app and did a bunch of clinical studies and found that we got a 67% reduction in clinically validated anxiety scores in people with generalized anxiety disorder, like the worst of the worst. And we now have like three positive clinical trials ranging like from 50 to 67% in reduction in anxiety from like anxious physicians to people struggling with sleep issues. And so I wanted to look at the mechanism, and it turns out there's a pretty simple three-step process that helps people unwind anxiety. And that's where the book came from, was all that research and, you know, just developing these programs and learning from my own patients.
Something that jumped out at me recently on one of your Instagram posts, Dr. Judd, was that most people with anxiety get preoccupied with trying to understand why they develop anxiety. I definitely fall into this bracket as somebody that thinks that if I can get to the root of what's going on, I can figure out, you know, how to solve it, which isn't necessarily always the best practice. Again, it's trial and error on my side. It's far outside my area of expertise. But talk to that about why most people with anxiety get preoccupied with trying to understand why they develop anxiety.
Yeah. And I wrote a chapter in my book on this because it is so common. So I call this the why habit loop. And the idea is that, you know, something causes anxiety. And we might just wake up in the morning and have a feeling of anxiety. That's what a lot of my patients with generalized anxiety disorder, you know, report. And so they start wondering, oh, why am I so anxious right now or today or for my whole life? And that why actually drives them in the wrong direction, because they, you know, if it's something in the past, maybe that triggered some anxiety, or, you know, who knows? But the why is not actually what helps them step out of the habit. It's really the what, helping them see what's happening right now, that they are having anxiety, and that they are probably doing something like getting caught up in a why habit loop that's just perpetuating it. When they can start to notice the what, that can help them start to get the perspective, map out these habit loops, and then work with the anxiety itself rather than wasting all that energy with the why. I think of it this way. It's kind of like, you know, we turn on our car engine and then we slam on the gas without putting it in gear. And we wonder why the car isn't driving forward. You know, that's and we're wasting all the fuel. That's a very inefficient way to go through life. And that's what these why habit loops are all about. And some of that is that it goes back to our survival brain, which, you know, fear is a helpful survival mechanism. If there's some rustling in the bushes, you know, it's important for us to go figure out, is that danger or not? And so that helps us survive. And then other ways that we survive are through planning. You know, we plan into the future. But if you mush those two together, fear plus future, fear of the future equals anxiety, where we might not actually be in danger right now, but we are wasting a ton of energy worrying about what might happen instead of actually planning so that we can prepare for whatever will, you know, might happen. There's a big difference between planning and worrying about the future.
Can you explain, just for people who are unfamiliar with the term habit loop, what is a habit loop?
Oh, sure. So a habit loop is how we form any type of habit, whether it's putting on our clothes in the morning, to eating food, to worrying. And the three elements that are critical for a habit loop are a trigger or a cue, and then a behavior, and then a result. So for example, and this is, you know, how we were, this is how our survival mechanism was set up. This is actually evolutionarily conserved all the way back to the sea slug. So very, very worked out process. If we see some, let's say that we see some food, there's the trigger. We eat the food, there's the behavior. And then our stomach sends this dopamine signal to our brain that says, remember what you ate and where you found it. And there's the result, or from a brain standpoint, it's rewarding for our brain because it activates our reward system. And that feeds back and says, hey, next time you go to this place, remember there's food there. It's really set up to help us remember and learn things. Same is true for avoiding danger. You know, if we see something dangerous, like we step out into a street and then, you know, like we're looking at our phone or something instead of looking both ways, step out in the street, we almost get killed. That helps us learn, hey, put your phone away, you know, look both ways before crossing the street. So the basic flavor of a habit loop, there are two basic flavors, positive and negative reinforcement. Positive reinforcement is about reinforcing behaviors that continue good feelings. Like we eat some ice cream, it tastes good, and we learn to eat ice cream. The negative reinforcement helps us avoid things that are harmful, like, you know, stepping out into a busy street. And by we learn, you know, to avoid those situations because they're unpleasant, and we can avoid the unpleasant things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. And it gives me a nice little segue, because something that I learned from your research and from consuming your content is about reward-based learning. So why the stop-it mentality doesn't work for things like worry and anxiety. Can you explore that a little bit with us?
Yes. And I'm laughing because I wish the stop-it mentality worked. I think of this, there was this great skit from Bob Newhart from the 1970s where you can find this on YouTube, where, you know, woman walks into a therapist's office and basically says, I have this problem. And he says, just stop it. And she says, I have this problem. He says, just stop it. You know, that's the whole skit. But the idea is, reward-based learning isn't based on the behavior itself. We often get sucked into this idea that if I could just change the behavior, you know, if I could stop smoking or stop overeating or stop worrying, you know, I need to figure out how to do that. That's all about willpower. Well, it'd be great if it worked, because then every time I saw a new patient, it would be a single visit. You know, they would say, you know, Dr. Brewer, I want to, okay, just stop it. You know, and then I'd say, go home and stop, you know, and they wouldn't need to come back. But that's not how our brains work. Our brains work based on how rewarding a behavior is. So if eating chocolate cake is rewarding, then we're going to learn to eat it again. So we have to focus on the reward or the lack of the reward in the behavior in order to stop it. I'll give you a concrete example. So my patients that come in to want to quit smoking, for example, you know, I don't tell them to stop smoking because they've already tried that and it hasn't worked, which is why they come to see me. So what I tell them to do, I tell them to go ahead and smoke, and they look at me like I'm crazy. You know, my doctor just told me to smoke. And I say, well, wait a minute, that's not it. You have to pay attention as you smoke. See what it tastes like, see what it smells like, et cetera. And then they come, I had a guy that was smoking 40 years, and he comes back after doing this, and he's like, how did I not notice, you know, cigarettes taste like shit? You know? And what that does is it taps into that reward system and helps people, you know, become disenchanted with the behavior without telling themselves, you know, smoking's bad for me. They just taste that cigarettes taste like crap. And this is, doesn't just go for cigarettes. My lab just studied we just published a study where we, in our Eat Right Now app, we build in this craving tool that, and this is for anybody, you know, anybody can download the app and use this. This craving tool helps people pay attention as they overeat. Are you ready for this? In this study, we found that it only takes 10 to 15 times of somebody really paying attention as they overeat for that reward value to drop below zero, so that they shift that behavior from overeating to not overeating. It doesn't take very long to change behavior. We just have to pay attention. And that fits with, you know, 20, 30, even 40 years of neuroscience showing that that's how you break habits. It's really about paying attention and updating that reward value.
So when it comes to food, I'm very curious to park on this, because there's a lot of people listening where cravings is a big thing. This episode's going out right before the new year. And again, probably people have overindulged and probably eaten more or drank more than they normally would. But throughout the year, whenever people are listening to this, cravings is a big thing. When it comes to the Eat Right Now app in particular, and the studies you've done and the research you've seen and with the people you've worked with and have came through the studies, is it mainly a mindfulness and awareness issue from your experience, or are there other things that people tend to struggle from a habit side when it comes to craving, or is it just about bringing that mindfulness, bringing that awareness, doing that consistently, and that will work for a majority of people from your experience, or do they need to add something else alongside it?
Well, I would say the awareness is key, and the awareness can be applied in three sequential ways. And this is actually why I wrote the book in three main sections, which is the first thing that we have to do is we have to bring awareness to the habit loop. You know, if we're not aware of what's happening, there's no way we can work with it. So if it's a craving, they've got to become aware of the craving as compared to, you know, having waking up to the fact that they're halfway through, you know, a candy bar or a chocolate bar or ice cream or something like that. Often we're just mindlessly going through life, so we're not even aware of it. I see this a lot with smoking. I see this with eating. I see this with worrying. I see this with all sorts of habits. So the first step is really to, you know, notice what's the trigger, what's the behavior, what's the result. And that I'll point out that the trigger is the least important part of the equation. Often people get stuck on the triggers, again, falling into those why habit loops. It's really about the behavior and the results. And the reason I say that is the second step is what you and I just talked about, which is paying attention to what's happening. Like, what am I getting from this behavior? You know, reward-based learning is based on how rewarding something is. So if we pay attention as we're doing the behavior or even right afterwards, we can see how rewarding or unrewarding it is, and when we start to become disenchanted with it. And this is where, you know, everything lines up from, you know, that even from research from the 1970s, these two researchers, Roscorla and Wagner, said basically, you know, the only way to change a behavior is to pay attention. So step one, awareness of the habit loop. Step two is awareness of the results of the behavior. And I simplify that to having people just ask themselves a question like, what am I getting from this, right? And it's not about thinking, you know, like, oh, I shouldn't overeat or I shouldn't smoke. It's really about feeling into their direct experience. What does this feel like when I overeat? And they start to see, you know, overeating doesn't actually feel very good. The third step is also about awareness as well. So when somebody's having a craving, for example, they can get curious, oh, what does a craving feel like? Well, let me ask you, okay, ready? Pop quiz, hotshot.
Let's do it.
What feels better, craving or curiosity?
Oh, well, curiosity feels better.
And so what about it? So that's actually in studies we've done with hundreds of people, that's what people report as well. What is it about that? Well, I'll stop quizzing you. Sorry. So
like I have the answers. It's in part three of the book. So I feel like I know what the answer is supposed to be. So I feel like it's skewed. I'm cheating with the test answers in front of me.
Okay. Yeah. So I will take you off the hot seat. But the idea here is that cravings often feel like they're going to last forever unless we do something about them, unless we make them go away. So I'll even have patients, you know, they come into my office. I had a patient who came in and he said, "Doc, I feel like my head's going to explode." He felt like his craving was that strong. And so we just mapped it out from moment to moment. I said, "Okay, describe what, you know, head exploding craving feels like." That's bringing in the curiosity. He's like, what does it feel like? And he started describing it to me. And I wrote down his descriptions. You know, it's like tightness, tension, burning. I wrote these down on a whiteboard and with the arrow. And I was like, tell me if it's getting stronger or weaker. And it was going up and up and up and up. And typically people feel like that's going to just keep going up until they do something to make it go away, whether it's eating the chocolate or whatever their favorite treat is. What this patient realized was that at some point that craving crested and then it started to get weaker and his eyes got really wide. And I said, well, what happened? He said, you know, usually I smoke a cigarette right now. And I didn't realize that if I just noticed this, the craving will actually go away on its own. So I have people get really curious about what those cravings feel like and map them out in their bodies. And it does a number of things. One is it helps them see, oh, these are just physical sensations. You know, my head's not going to explode. Two, these are constantly changing. And three, I don't have to act on the craving for it to go on away on its own. I've even had folks time the amount of time their craving lasts. The longest that somebody's ever reported ready for this? This is a food craving. It was, I think it was 12 minutes, 12 or 13 minutes. So it really doesn't, you know, cravings can feel like they're going to last forever. But when we bring this curiosity in and start noticing what's happening in our experience, it's not nearly as scary because we can see it, and we can see it for what it is, just physical sensations. And we can see that it goes away on its own. And that empowers us tremendously to know, oh, I can actually work with my cravings in a different way. Instead of doing something to suppress them or make them go away, I can just be with them. And that being with them is the doing, in a sense that that's the best thing that we can do, is not try to make them go away, but simply be curious and watch them come and go.
Very interesting that you use that as the description, because when I get cravings, and something that I've offered to clients, nutrition that I work with, is very similar, where I tell them to picture it like a wave, like it'll pass over you like a wave. But interestingly enough, as somebody who has a history of anxiety, more just overthinking anxiety, it's the same process that helps me manage through it. I think of anxiety, yep, like a wave that's going to pass over me. How closely related or unconnected or unrelated are cravings and anxiety from your experience, Dr. Judd?
So in the brain, cravings and anxiety activate the same network of brain regions. It's called the default one network. And what we found, my lab studied this specifically, when we look at the brain activity of people meditating and even people being curious, that same network gets quiet. So we know that they share brain real estate. And as you're describing, we know that they also share physical experience. There's a restless quality that is shared, whether it's a craving or it's anxiety. That restlessness says, do something, you know, and with anxiety, that doing is worrying. You know, it's like, oh, you know, the more I worry about something, I don't know what our brains are convinced that worrying is going to actually help us solve problems. But really, it's just, you know, it feels like it's better to do something, even though we're worrying, than doing nothing about something. But ironically, the doing nothing is the best way to go. We can learn to, you know, if we're going to do something, we can get curious about what those feelings of worry feel like. So there's that shared experience around restlessness. There tends to be a contraction that happens with both craving and anxiety and worry. So I think we see shared components both from a brain standpoint, both neurobiologically, but also from a body standpoint, where we feel, you know, these have similar feelings in our bodies. Is that your experience?
Yeah, it literally feels like it's the same thing, just aimed in a different direction.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. You said a great line there that worry can help us solve the problem. I've definitely fallen victim to that story, that self-fulfilling prophecy of, well, if I'm not anxious and I'm not worried, I won't get stuff done, which sounds so ludicrous when I say it out loud and when I think about it and reflect on it. But from your experience, what are some of the major misconceptions around anxiety and worry? And would you class those two things together, or would you have them as two separate ways of thinking about situations? So anxiety and worry, would you have them two sides of the same coin, or would you have them split as something else? And what would be some of the major misconceptions you see around them?
Yes. So they're certainly related. And in fact, if you look at the definition of anxiety, I think it says something like a feeling of worry or nervousness or unease about, you know, something with an uncertain outcome. So the feeling, I think of anxiety as a feeling in our body. We feel, you know, I feel anxious, that type of thing. And anxiety triggers the mental behavior of worrying. So their worry fits both in terms of the noun form, you know, the feeling of worry, and also is a mental behavior. So I would say they're related, but they are definitely different, because worrying is a behavior, whereas anxiety is a feeling. And I think you've touched on one of the primary misconceptions that I see with anxiety is that people feel like, well, if I'm not anxious, I don't feel like I'm going to get stuff done. And that actually goes back to, and I wrote about this in my book as well, because this is one of the big misconceptions around anxiety, is that, you know, whether it's performance anxiety or just getting stuff done, people feel like if they're not anxious, they're not going to get things done. And the primary misconception here is around what our natural tendency is, which is, our brains are really good at making associations. They like to associate A with B. The problem is, an association. In science, we talk about correlation and causation, and correlation does not equal causation, meaning if A and B happen at the same time, it doesn't mean that A caused B to happen. As an example, if we worry a lot, and we happen to be worrying and we get something done, then we assume, oh, it was because I worried, that was A, that I got something done. B, worry must have been because I was worrying, because I was anxious that I got the thing done. The problem is that there's no causal component there. And in fact, a fair amount of research has shown that the more anxious we are, the worse we do on things, whether it's getting things done or whatever. So this correlation of anxiety and getting things done, whether it's a performance or a project, is really, it hasn't been shown in science. And in fact, you can look at the opposite, where we can ask, what's necessary? Is anxiety necessary to get things done? That's when you start to get into the realm of causality. And in fact, when I ask people, well, what's it like? What's your mental state like when you get your best work done, or when you get the most stuff done? And what people report is when they're, in flow, or when they're in the zone, when they're just like cruising on a project, they are so far away from anxiety at that moment. They're so immersed in the project or the process, as Csikszentmihalyi talks about, the guy that coined the term flow, it's completely selfless. They're not even there because they are so merged with the action that they're doing. And by definition, if you are not there, you cannot be anxious. But people also report flow as being one of their peak experiences in life. It feels great. So here's an example of, anxiety is not necessary to get things done. And in fact, it can often get in the way. It's very energy taxing. It's very inefficient to be anxious and trying to get something done at the same time.
Yeah, it's such a peculiar one, because from my experience anyway, I've defaulted into anxiety and productivity and putting those two things together, that as long as I'm a little bit anxious, I'll get more done, and living in that story. But it's funny, because I used to get panic attacks and anxiety attacks, and if I didn't manage my anxiety within a certain realm, it tipped over completely, like to an overflowing glass, and you were right back at square one in a way worse position than when you started. I had to do years and years of training and CBT, etc., to kind of manage that and get it under control. But you had a beautiful line there, Dr. Judd, on worry is a behavior and anxiety is a feeling. I think that's really helpful for people, because it allows you to differentiate it in your own mind, and you can attack or work through whatever particular area you need to work on. I want to stay on anxiety for a second, though. With common triggers in anxiety, from your experience, what are some of the major triggers out there now that are kind of spiking people's anxiety?
Well, I would say in general, our brains don't like uncertainty. And there is a lot of uncertainty out there right now. And it's not that there wasn't uncertainty before, but for example, with the pandemic, there are spikes upon spikes of uncertainty, starting with, every time there's a new variant, there's a huge amount of uncertainty in terms of how dangerous and how infectious it's going to be. We also have uncertainty that is fed by, social media, where people are deliberately feeding misinformation around this or that. And the misinformation leads to uncertainty, because then people don't know who to believe. Instead of going to trusted news outlets, a lot of folks are getting their news on social media. And I have to say, not a trusted news source. your friend on Twitter is probably not an epidemiologist, for example, if you're talking about trying to get accurate information on the pandemic. So uncertainty is a huge driver of anxiety.
With anxiety in a habit loop, then, with that example, would the trigger be social media in this context? And then obviously you adjust the trigger versus the behavior and the results, because there's a lot of people listening, myself included, more so several years ago when I really, really struggled with anxiety. It's something I've got quite a good grasp on at the minute. But would the social media aspect then be the trigger? And would your advice be to kind of remove those triggers, in this case, the pandemic? But there's lots of different shapes and forms. You know, body confidence is a big thing for people, following fitness people on social media, comparison syndrome, all of these things. Would you have anxiety then, an anxiety habit loop, the trigger being the removal or reduction of social media? Or would you jump in at the behavior or the result and try and change it elsewhere?
Yeah, I wouldn't start with the trigger. And it's not that that social media is inherently bad. It's if we don't know how our minds work, we can't possibly work with our minds when there are triggers that come up. And it's really hard to avoid all the triggers in our lives. You know, so I would say, instead of trying to avoid or control the triggers, I would say focus on, like you're pointing out, you know, what's the behavior and what's the result. So if I go on social media and I'm triggered to get anxious by something, I can map out the process right in that moment. Oh, you know, I read this tweet or I read this post on Instagram and I got anxious. And then, you know, notice, oh, I start to worry when I'm triggered like this. And then what do I get from that worrying? You know, we can ask ourselves, what am I getting from this? And feel into our direct experience and see, oh, this is just leading to more anxiety. If we can do that, it can help us not only start to see where we're getting triggered and how our brain is reacting, it can help us start to become disenchanted right in that moment to see, wait a minute, you know, I'm getting caught up in this. When I worry, it's not actually helping anything. It's not keeping people safe. It's not solving problems. It's not helping me move forward in life. And then we can ask, well, what can I do instead? Can I get curious? Huh? What does this anxiety feel like? So the next time I go on social media, I could go in specifically, you know, put on my cape of curiosity, so to speak, and fly in. It's like, now I start to bring out my superpower, because we all can be curious. We can go, let me scroll through social media and notice those triggers and notice what it feels like to be anxious. Or as you pointed out, like, people go on social media and they see somebody that looks really buff, you know, and they're, wow, that person, that guy's ripped, or that woman looks like she's really in good shape, or wow, that person just posted a PR in terms of their running times. Man, I can't do that. We can notice those triggers and notice when we judge ourselves, you know, it's like, oh, I'm worse than, or even when we judge ourselves like, oh, I'm better than that person. Both of those can feed these reinforcement loops where we feel like, oh, I've got to get better, or wow, check me out, I am better. And we start to, you know, get a chip on our shoulder, which doesn't help either. Because then we have to support that chip. Those chips need to be fed. You know, they're never satisfied. So there we can explore, what am I getting from this? And we can bring curiosity in. And when we're judging ourselves, we can bring kindness in. And just notice what it feels like when we're kind to ourselves versus when we judge ourselves. To our brains, it's a no-brainer.
I love that. And you know, it's a Pandora's box when I think of that particular topic, about what you potentially triggers you on social media, whether it's an insecurity. For me, a lot of it's all kind of your self-worth, or else what I tie is valuable. Like the analogy I use, or the example I use, is if I tell somebody, you know, I see a post where someone's put up a picture of them winning a tennis tournament, I'm like, oh, brilliant, good for them, because like, I don't care about tennis. But if I see somebody with a best-selling book or a really good podcast or online social media following, I'm like, your brain goes into, why don't I have that? And it's funny, because if that was tennis, you wouldn't care. And it's so interesting. I have to ask myself that question and kind of jump down that rabbit hole regularly. But I think it's important for people that anxiety, that trigger, that thing that sparks within you is normally some form of your insecurity, your self-worth, your value system. Something is getting triggered within you, because if you put 100 people into a room, not everyone is going to react the same way, which tells you that it's your experience, your bias. So using that as feedback can be helpful. Definitely for me, when it came to coming to terms with my anxiety and getting that under control, that was the first step for me. It was kind of the foundation in which everything else was built. You have a great section in your book too, Dr. Judd, about, and I won't go into it for people, they should definitely check out Unwinding Anxiety at the end of this podcast. But one of the sections was why your previous anti-anxiety and anti-habit strategies failed. But I'm not going to unpack that, because I think people should read it for themselves. But what I am going to ask is, what are some of the popular, and when I say popular, I mean commonly used anti-anxiety strategies that you find don't work very well for people?
The biggest one that I find that doesn't work, and we've touched on it a little bit, is willpower. you know, where people just feel like if they were stronger, they could somehow just tell themselves to stop worrying. That's the biggest one that I see. The second biggest that I see is where they're trying to avoid, trying to figure out the all their anxiety triggers and avoid them. And then I would say the third one, well, the third one isn't really an anti-anxiety strategy. No, it is. It is. This why habit loop, we talked about that as well. So when people, they try to figure out why they're anxious, thinking that if they can figure that out, they will solve their anxiety as well. None of those work, unfortunately.
With willpower, what do you find is the biggest misconception with it? Is it just to use it and tell yourself to stop it? Or is the misconception around willpower something else?
The biggest misconception in general around willpower is that it is powerful. So I like that it is willpower, because the will is actually not very powerful. In neuroscience, if you look at it from a neuroscience perspective, willpower is more myth than muscle. I'm going to repeat that in case folks didn't hear me correctly. Yes, willpower is more myth than muscle. It'd be great if it were powerful, but it's really not.
I love that. I think that's, I'm just going to let that sit for people, because there's definitely a misconception. I've done it myself in the past where you're relying on willpower, not realizing that that runs out. And also that changes, like based on your day and based on what you've done. And for me, based on how I've slept and all these other factors play a massive role in how good or how strong my willpower is. And that muscle just isn't very strong a lot of the time. When it comes to the book, then Unwinding Anxiety in part two, as you said, you broke it into three parts, which I love. Part one, part two, part three. But in part two, which is updating your brain's reward value, second gear, you talk about how your brain makes decisions, why we prefer cake to broccoli. I think that's very prevalent for the audience of this podcast. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
So the idea from a survival standpoint is that cake is more calorically dense than broccoli is. So if we didn't have an abundance of food, you know, if we were out on the savannah having to forage for food every day, our brain would say, hey, you know, pack in as many calories as you can, because you never know when it's going to be feast or famine. In today's world, for most of us that have access to food, it's not feast or famine, and yet this mechanism is still in place. So we learn to associate cake, for example, with birthday parties, with celebrations, with, you know, promotions, you know, holidays, all of these festive occasions. So we lay down these associative memories where we learn to associate, you know, good things with eating cake. As an example, we don't tend to break out the broccoli at somebody's birthday. Hey, light the candles on your broccoli. You know, let's all dive in. I can't wait. That broccoli looks great. You know, no, it's about cake. So here we've formed these associations. And so our brain learns, hey, you know, if you're feeling bad, you should eat some cake. Hey, if you're celebrating, you should eat some cake. Hey, if you're bored, why don't you eat some cake? Because it feels good. So we learn what's called, we learn these associations based on what's called hedonic hunger, meaning based on emotions, rather than homeostatic hunger, which is just a fancy term for whether we're actually hungry or not. And that's a problem in modern day. That's why we have an obesity epidemic.
Would all junk food fall into that hedonic hunger category? I know junk food's a relative term, but cake, chocolate, ice cream, McDonald's, Burger King, etc.
One thing I can say about junk food is that it tends to be designed specifically to be, I think of it as cravogenic. You know, they even joke. They say crafted. You know, I see these billboards that say crafted for your craving. I think that was a McDonald's one that I saw once. Or, you know, this is. There are even cereals called Crave.
Yeah, and Pringles pop because you can't stop. It's just because.
Oh, yeah. And then, yeah, Ruffles, but you can't just eat one. And then the parentheses is because we designed it that way, you know, for potato chips. So all of these junk food is junk food. It's called junk food because it doesn't have nutrient, you know, much nutrient value. It's not designed to be healthy for us, as regular, you know, is whole food is when you eat something in its whole form. So junk food in particular is designed just to get us to eat more of it rather than to provide nutrients and help us be healthy.
Yeah, I think it's important that understanding for people who struggle with overeating, who struggle with sugar, who struggle with food. And it's not to eliminate those foods. People who are long-term listening to the podcast know my philosophy. There's no good or bad food. There's nutrient-dense foods and there's nutrient foods that are devoid of nutrients. But you don't want to consume those foods every day in large quantities or else you're not going to feel very good. When it comes to habits then, how long would you recommend, or from your experience, how long does it generally take to change a habit? Whether that's worrying, whether that's overeating, whether that's anxiety or food related, or from your experience, does it take longer or shorter to change certain habits than others? What have you found from the research and from the people you've seen?
Well, this is a great question, and there's a lot of misinformation on the internet. Not intentional misinformation, but I think people trying to give people answers that they want to hear. You know, there's a meme out there around it takes 21 days to break a bad habit. That's based on some guy. It was a plastic surgeon writing a book. I don't know. It was like the 1960s about how some of his patients took 3 weeks to get used to their new nose job. And then suddenly this became a meme on the internet. It takes 21 days to break a bad habit. Wow. Wow. Or form a good habit, you know, that type of thing. So what we do know is that there's not a huge amount of great research in general around habit change. But what I've seen in my research, and also makes a lot of sense, is that it's one critical ingredient that we've talked about is awareness, right? And the more someone can pay attention to how rewarding or unrewarding a behavior is, the faster that behavior will change. In my lab, you know, in this study that we recently published, we found that it only takes 10 to 15 times for that reward value to change dramatically, like drop below zero. Now, the reason I say that it makes sense is from an evolutionary perspective, we can't afford to take a lot of time to be chased a bunch of times, let's say by the tiger, to realize that that's a dangerous animal. We've got to learn that pretty quickly. So if we pay attention and we know exactly what a tiger sounds and looks like, we can learn that pretty quickly. We can do the same thing with any unhelpful habit. And the more unhelpful it is, let's say eating a bunch of junk food, the more we pay attention, the faster that habit changes. I'll give an example. I had a patient who used to sit down every night and she would watch television with her daughter as a way to bond with her. And she would eat an entire bag of potato chips, not a small one, not like a snack size, but an entire large bag of potato chips. And what I had her do was I had her pay attention as she was eating those potato chips. And she did this for a long time. You know, she had this habit really set up. What I had her do was pay attention as she ate the potato chips. And I asked her to ask herself, with each potato chip, how little is enough? Like, when are you satisfied? Are you ready for this? It only took two potato chips for her to get enough salt and fat. You know, potato chips, when you really pay attention, they're pretty salty. So when people pay attention, they realize, wow, you know, I'm done. I'm done with two or three or a handful as compared to a whole bag. And I think of her as my two potato chip lady, because all she had to do was pay attention and she broke that habit pretty quickly.
Do you find with that example, do some people grasp it a lot faster than others? So for example, when she did it, from what you're describing, the first time she brought a lot of conscious awareness to it, a lot of curiosity to it, she was able to figure out, okay, I'm good after two. Do you find that there's a spectrum for how long it takes somebody to realize that actually I'm full at two? And the reason I ask that question is the pushback generally when you're trying to get people, from my experience, to bring awareness to their eating or mindfulness to their food or just not mindlessly eating, is that some people grasp it very quickly, where from my experience, others, it takes a lot more time based on their starting point. What's your experience been with that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I'm glad you bring it up. The concept itself is pretty straightforward. Most people get that pretty quickly, but the concept doesn't mean anything. You know, it's our our thinking brains don't hold a candle to our feeling bodies. Our feeling bodies are really where, you know, that's where behavior is driven. So somebody can understand something. And what I find is that people tend to get in their own way when it comes to this habit change process, where they overthink it, or they get stuck in their head where they're stuck in this like, oh, I shouldn't eat potato chips. And they think that they're doing the practices. When in reality, the people that just, you know, it's kind of like, shut up and do the practice, you know, like tell their brains to not overthink things. When they just really get curious and notice. So I would say the more curious people can be, the faster they break these habits, because they're really exploring like, oh, what am I getting from this? You know, is this bite better than the last one or worse than the last one? So here it's really about dropping into somebody's direct experience, really feeling it in their body and ramping up their curiosity. The concept is pretty simple. It's really about people getting out of their own way.
Yeah, that's definitely been my experience as well. So I'm really happy to hear that it's not the action and knowing what to do that people struggle with, it's the execution. But from what you said there, it's bringing more curiosity to it and just bringing more awareness to it consistently until you get to the point where you're able to have the two chips or have, you know, the bar of chocolate and not eat the family size pack, or have a couple of scoops of ice cream and not eat the whole tub of Ben and Jerry's. All things that I've done in the past where I've had serious control issues when it came to food, that all are nothing. Like one of my misconceptions, Dr. Judd, was always I won't keep it in the house, you know, systems over willpower. I'm like, I can't keep it in the house. If I buy a family pack size of Mars bars or Snickers, I'm going to eat all of them. So I literally have to go and buy one, knowing that I'll eat one, or buy none. But I've changed my mind about that in recent years. I think, again, it's more education, more awareness, following content like yours, reading the books, following the content you put on social media, the podcasts, etc. But when it comes to in any direction, I'm very curious, whether it's anxiety-based or food-based. I know the Eat Right Now app, which I'll link in the show notes for people, really, really helpful for those who need to work through their emotional eating. Is there anything that you've changed your mind about in recent years where you once believed one? I know we didn't get into this at all today. I know you struggled from listening to another podcast. I think it was Rich Roll or Shane Walsh. It was one of the other episodes I was listening to you with, where you had IBS in medical school because of the stress and anxiety. Very similar to me, something I struggled with, that psychosomatic and stress level where my IBS flares up. And, you know, I didn't realize that it was all stress related for me. I thought it was food, where there was a massive combination. Is there anything you've changed your mind about in recent years when it comes to whether it's anxiety, habits, which is your area of expertise, or just food and emotional eating in general? Is there anything that jumps to mind when I say that?
Well, the biggest thing that I've changed my mind about has actually been the willpower piece. And so that was my big thing. I thought that it was because I just pushed through college that I got into medical school, et cetera, et cetera. And so I actually took that approach to everything that I did. I remember going on my first week-long silent meditation retreat, you know, and the instructions to pay attention to your breath, you know, when your mind wanders, bring it back, which seems pretty simple. The instruction is pretty simple. Yet when we approach it from a willpower standpoint, I found myself crying uncontrollably on the shoulder of the retreat manager by day three, because I was thinking, yeah, I can get into medical school, but I can't pay attention to my breath. So that was the biggest game changer in terms of shifting what my approach was and what my thinking was. Now, that was, you say, in the last couple of years, that was about 10 years ago. But in the last couple of years, it's only been kind of reinforced how important shifting from willpower to curiosity is. So I would say there hasn't been anything that's been a big aha moment besides, you know, discovering that anxiety could be driven like a habit. So I hadn't known that. It's really been that shift from, you know, from willpower to curiosity, that shift from brute force to kindness, you know, bringing kindness to myself.
I just have one final question that gives me a nice little jumping off point from what you said there. If you could go back, Dr. Judd, to when you were in medical school, and particularly that time frame of your life when you were trying to work through willpower and broke down. And again, that connects very deeply with me, that own inner critic where, you know, I would achieve external success, but I'm like, why the fuck can't I control my mind? I'm like, I'm literally having panic attacks and anxiety attacks. What's wrong with you? Like, and it's getting control and getting to the grasp of that voice, etc. But from your experience in that time of your life, what advice would you offer yourself, or what do you know now that you wish you had known back then?
Yeah, well, I think this just builds on what I was saying earlier, which is, you know, chill out. And by that, I mean, stop working so hard to try to brute force through life. You know, it's kind of like, I found that I was, you know, in college, I was beating my head against the wall with everything. And literally, you know, I get headaches when studying and whatnot. And in fact, I didn't know how my mind worked. What I needed to do was know how my mind worked. And so the advice I would give myself is, hey, instead of continually beating yourself, your head against the wall, look for the door. And that door is the doorway into understanding how our bodies and our minds work. And in fact, we even, because this is, you know, this is such a foreign concept for people, we created another app called Unwinding by ShareCare, which is more of a general app to help people kind of understand, you know, it's like a manual for life to help them understand all of these misconceptions that we have around life when we're trying to improve ourselves, you know, just trying to, you know, brute force it. And instead, you know, there are a bunch of mini courses in there that train people, hey, you know, this is what kindness is like. This is what, you know, these are the procrastination habit loops that you can look out for and work with. You know, this is how stress and anxiety form, et cetera, et cetera. And if folks have, you know, significant anxiety, obviously our Unwinding Anxiety app is aimed in that direction. So that's really, you know, the advice I would give myself is, hey, look for that instruction manual. It's there in your own experience, you know, and go from there as compared to blindly trying to just push your way through life.
That's such a fantastic way to finish. And I'm going to link those apps, Eat Right Now, Unwinding Anxiety and Craving to Quit, in the description for today's podcast, alongside the books and alongside the website. But Dr. Jude, is there anywhere, and again, I'm so grateful for the message you put out there, for your time. I've got loads of golden nuggets myself from today's episode, as I always do when I listen to other podcasts that you're on. But is there anywhere in particular you want to send people to, and any links or anything you want to give outside of what we've talked about already that you want to share? Please do that now.
Yeah, I would say the simplest thing is my website, which is just drjud.com, drjud.com. That's got a bunch of resources and information about these programs and my books.
And for everybody listening, I will link everything we talked about in today's episode, the website, the apps, the books on briankeenfitness.com in the show notes and in the description wherever you are listening to podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, etc. Dr. Jude, thank you so much again for what you do. Thank you even more for your time, and keep doing what you're doing.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
There you have it, Dr. Jude on unwinding anxiety, using curiosity to manage cravings, and finally breaking your bad habits. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it. Definitely going to go back on this one with a notepad and pen. A lot of stuff jumped out at me here. So as I said, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. As always, if you enjoyed today's podcast, take a screenshot, pop it up on your Instagram stories, and you can tag me, Brian_Keen_fitness, and you can tag Dr. Jude on Instagram. And if it's your first time listening to the podcast and you enjoyed today's episode, hit that follow or subscribe button for episodes coming every single Monday. That's all from me this week. Catch you all next Monday.